Session number 17286.
Douglas Arnold, reel 3.
But, of course, Jock Lewis thought it would be a good idea to get us up in the air again before we all ran home to our mothers, I suppose. So the next day we were up again. There wasn't much laughing and joking, I can tell you. Although previously our spirits were so high and our nervous tension was such that we had laughed and joked while we were waiting to jump out. We were all 21, 22, so we were laughing and joking and pretending that we were brave. But after these two fatalities, I remember that we weren't so brave, and we now realise that there's a good chance of getting hurt. So this time we weren't laughing and joking, and we jumped out, and thank God the training was nearly over, the parachute training anyway was nearly over then, and we had no more fatalities. And it was back to the compass then, I suppose, night marching, and then we heard that we had a job in store out in Libya. It was the time of the year when strikes, I could never understand the strategy, but every September time there were strikes. And the generals would decide that the summer holidays were over and we'd have a strike, and the Germans had brought over the new 109Fs, and these had been stationed in a little airfield, perhaps it was an airfield called Tamimi, T-M-I-M-I, out not too far from the coast in Libya, not a long way from Tripoli. And the RAF reconnaissance had decided that they couldn't meet these 109Fs, they were superior planes, and they felt that it would be a good idea if we could go there and destroy them. So we were briefed on this and told what was wanted, what we were to do, and we went off, three planes I believe, and we flew to a forward landing ground that was still within Egypt, and then flew on to near to Tamimi, and we were fired upon. We lost one of our planes, one of the three Bombays, and there would have been, I believe that there were 40 odd men in this group, so there would have been, if you think of 12, there were 10 men to a stick. And there must have been 12 or 13 people on each plane. So one plane was shot down, and I'm not sure what happened to them. Most of them, I think, were taken prisoner. And the two planes that got through to near to Tamimi, we ran into a storm, and when I jumped, the wind, it was dark, of course, the wind was howling, it was gale force, and I hit the ground with a terrible thump and was dragged a long way, and eventually managed to extricate myself from the parachute and started to look for the remainder of the stick. The officer in charge was Paddy Main, who later on became Colonel Paddy Main, and it was decided that they would have to leave me behind with another fellow who was also rather badly injured, and that they would go on and try to do their best. And I thought there was a good chance that I would be able to walk with this other fellow due south into the desert to where the long-range desert group was likely to be going to be waiting for us to pick us up. The others went on. They had no success, really. They had no success. Some of them met Germans, and many of them were taken prisoner. And the whole affair was a fiasco. We didn't destroy any of the 109Fs. We probably gave the Germans a hell of a fright. And the remainder of my stick, having failed in their attack, turned south to look for the LRDG. Walked past us in the dark, unfortunately. And the following morning, I saw somebody on the skyline, hoped it might have been the LRDG, waved my hands towards him and ran towards him, but unfortunately it was an Italian gentleman, an Italian soldier, out for an early morning stroll from his camp, which was just over the sand dunes, and he came racing towards me, waving his gun, and I hadn't got a gun, of course. And he was waving his gun, and I sat down promptly, and so did my colleague. And he wasn't sure what we were, but he knew that he had to keep pointing his rifle at us. And people who say that the Italians were not good soldiers and that they were scared stiff, etc., well, they hadn't met this gentleman. He took us both back to his little camp. And it turned out that they were kind of pioneers, and they were doing a road back there. And they were grade 3 troops, but they'd taken me prisoner, you know. They were grade 3 troops.
What equipment had you gone into the raid with, personally?
Well, I would have had a revolver. We didn't use automatics because of the sand. The revolvers worked better once they had sand in them. And I'd had plastic explosives, revolver, and time pencils, things like that. But I'd given all this stuff to those who were going on, you see. It was more use to them. All I'd kept was my emergency rations and a water bottle. So I didn't think it was really worthwhile having a fight with this gentleman with a very, very long rifle out in the desert. He took us back to his camp, and they treated us with great amusement. Once they found that we were British, and we said that we were engineers, and we'd fallen off the back of a truck, you see, so that was to account for us. And luckily, they were so far behind the lines that they should have known that this was a patent untruth. But when we said that we'd fallen off the back of a truck, and we were like them, building roads, they thought, by crikey, you know, we shouldn't really be here. So they packed up and they took us back to their lines, and handed us over to people who fortunately didn't realise what they had in their possession. If they'd known that they had a couple of SAS fellows, they would have been on. But no, they didn't. Again, we told them that we were engineers, that we'd been taken out into the desert to do some recce work, that we'd fallen off the truck, the truck had driven off into the distance and left us there, and we were very, very sorry to be any trouble to them, and if they cared to send us back, they could do, you know, they didn't really mind. But they treated us very, very kindly, very nice. I never once, I was a prisoner of war altogether on this occasion for 2 years, you know, a good 12 months, and never once did I see any brutality. There was a little cruelty, but anyway.
What kind of cruelty?
Oh, I was in one camp where there were several thousand men and 10 lavatories. And there were 10 holes in the ground. By any standards, that was cruelty.
Is that in North Africa or
Italy? No, that was in Italy. But I don't think that the Italians perhaps thought it was... That was their standard, you know. But whatever. I was in a camp called Tarhuna. And met lots of fellows, including the two gentlemen to whom I had refused admission to our boat in the cave in Crete. They had gone further up the land, up along the coast, found a rowing boat, which they had rowed across and landed at Tobruk behind the German lines, and they'd been taken prisoner again, and they'd been put in this camp. And it was lovely to meet them in this camp. They were delighted to see me, and they didn't hold out any... They weren't angry with me because I'd refused them a place on the boat. But what bravery on their part to get a rowing boat. And, you know, it must be about probably 300 miles, you know, from Crete to North Africa. Farther if you go to Tobruk. And they'd rode it. Oh, well, there we are. Anyway, this was a nice little holiday camp. They treated us very, very well. But within a very short period, they shipped us off to Italy. Went to a camp in Naples, a reception camp in Naples, where they were very, you know, I won't say that they were... Yeah, they were kind. They did their best. They didn't have enough... I mean, the population of Italy was starving, so why should they give us lots of food? They gave us enough. You know? They gave us enough. And after a while, we went from this reception camp, which was by Naples on the west coast. We crossed the spine of Italy over to the east coast and went up the lovely Adriatic coast to a place called Porto San Giorgio, and then on a little mountain railway up to Servigliano, where there was a camp, that's all you can call it. It had been a military establishment, and it was now overcrowded, and it had 10 lavatories. A bit rough on occasions, until we got some more lavatories. We were put into huts, can't think how many there were in each hut, really. A couple of hundred, I suppose, in each hut. Yeah, a couple of hundred in each hut, there must have been. Because we were counted in 30s, and visualising it, there must have been, there must have been the best part of 8 or 9 groups of 30 outside the hut when we were being counted. And 3 sevens of 21, yeah. There must have been more than 200 people in each hut. So it was a bit fighted at night, wasn't it? You know, you could smell your neighbour. We were in double bunks, wooden double bunks.
If I could just take you a bit ahead, because I've recorded a lot on Italian.
I'm sure you have, sorry.
If I can take you ahead to 43, when Italy collapsed,
yeah.
The Badoglio crisis.
Yes.
And what happened to you then?
Well,
were you still at Servigliano?
No, they moved me from Servigliano up to another camp. The number escapes me. But we were at Macerata, which wasn't very far from Rimini. It's still in the Marche. And eventually we kept hearing wonderful stories that, you know, the British troops were advancing, this, that and the other. And we noticed that our guards were getting sloppier and sloppier and friendlier, and that some of them were even trying to get into our good graces. And you will know that you had to get into groups for the distribution of Red Cross parcels. Sometimes there would be one between five, and sometimes there'd be one each, etc. But you were always in fives or sixes, so that you could share these parcels, you see. And I had inherited, on my move from Servigliano, I had inherited a young fellow who was... He was much younger than us. Not in age, but in mentality, he was much younger than us. And when one of my real muckers had been repatriated, because he was in the RAMC, he had made me promise to look after this young man. And I said to him, let's escape. And he said, no. He said, I've just got, through the Red Cross, he said, I've just got a new piano accordion. He'd sent for this piano accordion. He said, I don't think I'd like to lose it now. And if I can't escape with it, I said, oh, come on, let's go. No, he said, I think I'll take a chance. Well, I knew that we were going to, that those who stayed behind were going to be sent to Italy, to Germany, sorry. They were going to be sent to Germany, weren't they? And I had no intention of going to Germany. Germany was north, the British troops were south. So I waited an opportunity, spoke to one or two of the guards, who I got the impression that they wouldn't fire their long, long antique rifles at me if I escaped. I found a place where I'd always thought was a good place when there were a lot of guards there. I thought, well, this is the place to go when the time comes. And I got out. I got out. Nobody fired at me, thank God. And after about an hour, going south, on country lanes, of course, and there was a great deal of confusion around, and people were galloping past. A lady called me into her house, and she held out some clothes, kind of blue, not denims, but blue dungarees, and a check shirt. And she made me understand that these were for me. So I took them, and then I looked, I blended a bit, but of course I had a moustache, a very English military moustache, and an English haircut. And I don't think that any Germans would have mistaken me for the local vampire. However, I went south, and I got very, very close to Servigliano, which by then had been abandoned. And I saw the old camp and thought, how nice. Went south again, and a farmer looked after me for a day or two, and he said, oh, the English troops are coming, the English troops are coming, but unfortunately, the German troops came, and they knew that we were, there were several prisons like myself in the area, and they rounded us up, and they, fortunately for me, they were Fallschirmjäger, paratroopers, and I didn't tell them that I was a paratrooper or in the SAS, because I didn't think that I'd be very, very welcome. But I pointed to their insignia and said how highly I regarded the Fallschirmjäger, and I had been on Crete and seen the glorious deeds which they had done, etc. And I said that I too wanted to be a Fallschirmjäger, you see, and they thought that I must be quite a nice bloke. So when they got me into the camp, back to Servigliano, which was by now, in a few days it had been filled. They said, oh, we can't put you with these cattle. That was the word. They spoke reasonable French, which I spoke, but remember, I'd been in the hotel business. They spoke reasonable French and had a little English. And they said, oh, Douglas, it's no use putting you with these cattle. You know, an aspiring Fallschirmjäger can't be with them. We'll put you in this office building here, and they put me in the old office, which I knew very, very well, and I'd always said when I was at Servigliano that if ever I get the chance to escape, the office is the place to do it, because the wall was lowered at the back and there were some trees near there. So they brought me cognac and chocolate, and they sat talking to me about various ways of jumping. They had come down from Monte Carlo. They'd only been in Italy a few days, and they'd come down to strengthen the backbone of the local troops, and they were certainly doing that. Yeah. Anyway, they gave me cognac and chocolate, and they said, first thing in the morning, we'll be here to see you, and we know that you English like bacon and eggs, and we'll get you something for your breakfast, and keep away from those cattle over there. Of course, as soon as they'd gone, I was out of the office, went behind the office, saw that there were no guards on duty at all, got over the wall and into the football field, which was behind it. We used to occasionally be permitted to walk round the football field. So I knew, and you know, I'd always had escape in my mind, hadn't I? So I kept an eye open, and when I got to the football field, I went to the far corner where I knew that the ground, the wire was at its lowest, and that it was nearest to the road. Oh yes, we'd once been allowed out to walk that way, and I can remember having walked with the other prisoners along the road and saying, oh, there's the football field there. So once I was in the football field, I thought, ah, I'm all right. If I get to that far corner, that's the nearest point to the road. When I got there, now, these fellows had been with me, feeding me with cognac and chocolate, and possibly that was the reason I escaped, the amount of cognac that they'd given me. So it was by now midnightish. By now it was midnightish, and when I got to the far corner, to this wire, there was a young German soldier and a local Italian girl having a little bit of, well, a kiss and a cuddle in the ditch. There was the the grass verge, the ditch, the bank, the wire, you see. And they were on the bank, close to the wire, having a little kiss and a cuddle, and he was saying the equivalent of come on, and she was saying, oh no, you mustn't, etc. And I was lying there praying that she would say, oh well, all right, and then they'd go away. And eventually, thank God, she decided to let him have his wicked way, and after about 10 minutes of giggling, they went away. I got through the wire. I didn't have to, you know, I was careful not to tear my blue clothes, but I wasn't careful about not making a noise. And then I knew where to run. I ran along the road, kept doing a left, got back to this farmer where I had been taken prisoner and left the few things that I'd acquired over the, you know, bits and things. And he very kindly had put them away for me. And then I went south. I went south, 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 staying in the Marche, and eventually I got into real bandit country and met the Partigiano. They persuaded me not to go any further, to stay with them, and I stayed with them for almost a year.
What was the exact place where these Partigiani?
Oh, were? Yeah, the exact place. Saint Egidio alla Vibrata. It was a little tiny hamlet, very similar to where I live now, close to the border between the Abruzzi and the Marche. In fact, I think that we were in the Abruzzi, but we counted ourselves as Marchigiano, and I eventually became an honorary Marchigiano, of course. For the simple reason that the nearest, although we were really in the Abruzzi, the nearest town was Ascoli Piceno, which was definitely the Marche, and so these people always counted themselves as Marchigiano, although they weren't.
Ascoli what?
Ascoli, A-S-C-O-L-I, Ascoli, Piceno, P-I-C-E,
Piceno.
E-N-O, Piceno. That was about 12 miles away, yes. So the local terrorists, as the Germans called them, the Partigiano, were a bit of a strange group. They all called themselves communists, but they all had a Ferrari. No, all Maseratis they were. They all had a Maserati stacked away in the garage, you know, and plenty of money. And we used to go and do jobs, and they had a strange idea of time. Timetables no longer existed there. And if you wanted to do a job on the railway, you couldn't say, oh, the train goes through every day at 4 o'clock. We just knew that it would go through sometime in the afternoon, or in the evening, or the early morning. So we used to get there in plenty of time. And because I had actually knew a little bit about explosives, they called me an expert, you see. I was a real demolitionist, just because I had once set fire to a firework or something. You know, my idea of explosives was light the blue touch paper and stand well clear. That's all I knew. But to them, using this stolen German explosives, I was an expert, you see. So I used to set these jobs up, you see, and then we used to wait and wait and wait. And towards 5 o'clock in the afternoon, or perhaps earlier, there'd be the occasional look at the wristwatch, and they'd say, you know, I've got to meet the wife at 4 o'clock, or I've got to pick up the kids from school, or I promised to take the wife to the dentist. Everything happened at 4 o'clock, you see. By now it's 4:40. And what they really meant was that they were off home, and all of a sudden they'd be, look, Doug, you know the way, you'll be all right here. And there was Douglas, left all alone with a railway line and a box of stolen ammunition, stolen explosive. They thought that this was quite the thing to do. They used to go back and say, oh, he knows more about it than us. And that was their rather slap-happy manner. They would do the same thing when we managed to rob a convoy. Any flour that we got would be taken home, never mind distributing it to the poor. They'd never heard of Robin Hood. No. This was all stacked in the garage alongside the Maturati, you see. And, I tried to steer them along the... No, Doug, we don't do it that way, you see. But it's all right, you know, in time, there'll be enough for everybody. In the meantime, there was really only enough for us. And very often, there wasn't enough for us, and we went very, very hungry. And the house in which I lived was quite something. They had a standard of poverty, and you'll have been told this before, they had a standard of poverty which doesn't exist here in Great Britain, and we British people can't conceive of the poverty. Where I lived, they had a table and some chairs. There was nothing on the wall. My wife says that this wall is overcrowded, and perhaps some people might say it's overcrowded. There was one picture, no, there was one thing in a frame in this house, and that was over the matrimonial bed, and it said, it was a little religious text, and it said, God is good, or Jesus is with us, or something like that. And that was all they had. There were no pictures of Granny, no pictures of us at Blackpool or the seaside. Nothing. There was no Radio Times delivered there. They had no radio, no electricity. They had electricity. Occasionally we had electricity, yep, we had electricity. But most of the time it was rushlights. And we made our rushlights ourselves. And in the evening we sat round the fire. If it was winter, we had a tiny little fire at night, and we sat round there telling stories. And I, of course, had to tell stories about London. I don't think I'd ever been to London. Well, not often, anyway. Certainly knew nothing about London. I knew nothing about London nightlife. But these people wanted to know all about London nightlife and the balls and the cinemas. Some of them had never been to the cinema, you know. So they didn't want to know about a house like this in Tulloch Cavern. They wanted to know about the lights in London, so I invented these stories about the lights in London, and according to my stories, I went to a different nightclub every night of the week. We were out roller skating and doing this, that and the other. Oh, yes. And they lapped it up. They thought it was lovely. And that's the way it was. We lived this quiet life. We'd go out, rob a train, come back and tell stories about the bright lights in London. God. It was hilarious. Looking back, it was hilarious. But all the time, I was very, very conscious of the danger. And they always asked me... These people, of course, knew that I was SAS. And by now, the SAS had become a great thing. And they'd read about it, and they heard that we were given escape money. Sovereigns, you know. And they wanted to know where my sovereigns were, and I said, oh, I've hidden them well away from here. So if I get killed, you know, whoever kills me for my sovereigns won't get the sovereigns. And they said, oh, very wise, because these people...